This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
And I'm Bob Kinzel. We're broadcasting live in the noon hour from NPR's worldwide headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Today and tomorrow, Vermont Edition is examining Vermont's congressional delegation, how it represents the interests of Vermonters, and roles that the three members play in the politics of Capitol Hill.
We're in Studio 32 here at NPR, and our guests today are the three members of Vermont's congressional delegation, Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat, and the most senior member of the U.S. Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent who is in his second term as a senator, and Vermont's sole House member, Congressman Peter Welch, a Democrat, who's been elected to four terms in the House.
It is a rarity to have all three of you together for a news interview, and we're glad to be here in Washington, D.C. with you for a special 90-minute broadcast of Vermont Edition. Thanks very much to all three of you for coming today.
Thank you.
So let's just find out first, as we go live at just after noon, what's happening right now in Washington as we look at the government shutdown, debt ceiling debates, and other issues. Congressman Welch, your counterparts in the House have been, some of them, have been meeting this morning with President Obama. What's the latest?
Well, really, this is a decision that John Boehner has to make, whether to reopen government, and he could do that simply by putting a bill on the floor where 200 Democrats would support it and over 20 Republicans have indicated they'd support a clean continuing resolution, that is a budget to turn the lights on. But they had a conference this morning about the debt ceiling and turning the lights on in government. Early reports are that they are talking about a six-week extension of the debt ceiling, which I suppose is progress, but it's a long way from just absolutely asserting we pay our bills. And it doesn't do anything about the shutdown. So it may be a step in the right direction. I think John Boehner's feeling the pressure. He knows that it's the wrong thing to allow America to default. The catastrophic consequences of that are unacceptable. But it's a long way from where we need to be. Turn the lights on, pay our bills.
How about over on the Senate side? We just heard Congressman Welch mention that John Boehner is talking about an end to the debt ceiling debate, raising that cap for a short term, 6 weeks. Senator Leahy, how would that go down in the Senate?
Well, that by itself is one thing that could pass, but I think that the Senate would be inclined to add on to it something to stop the close down in the government. We sent over a continuing resolution that effect some time ago at the request of Speaker Boehner, where those of us in the Democratic caucus had to cast some very painful votes cutting a number of programs that we feel strongly for because we were told that the Republicans in the House would accept that and that there would not be a government shutdown. Instead, we passed it, and then they decided, well, we're going to shut down anyway because the Tea Party said we got to have a shutdown. Now, you've got, of course, a couple in the Senate who are running for president, and they just soon shut down everything. But, you know, this is a nihilistic attitude toward government. That means, somebody said in a column today, we have people still watching out for satellites that may hit us, or meteors that may hit us. We don't have anybody to check the food that we buy at the grocery stores every single day. Now, this is ridiculous.
Senator Sanders, I know you were hoping to be in Vermont this weekend. It doesn't look like that's likely to happen. Do you think that there will be movement on this?
Well, things are moving rapidly as deadlines hit us. Senator Leahy and I are going to be going to the White House in a little while to get an update from the president. I guess Congressman Welch will be going very shortly as well. Here's what I hope that everybody will understand, and Senator Leahy made this point, as did the congressman. When folks talk about the need for compromise, what everybody has got to understand is the Democratic caucus already made a huge and major compromise. I'm a member of the Senate Budget Committee. We passed a reasonably good budget in the United States Senate. Not everything I wanted, but it was reasonably good. It protects the most vulnerable people in this country. It finally starts to ask the one out of four large corporations in America who don't pay a nickel in taxes to start paying their fair share of taxes. That was a good budget, reasonably good budget. What we ended up compromising is taking the House budget, which was sequestration levels of $986 billion, which was a bad budget. But the reason we did that is we were under the understanding, as Senator Leahy just said, is that Boehner had reached an agreement with the majority leader, Senator Reid, that if we passed that clean CR, we would have a continuing resolution. Government would remain open. So we've already made a major compromise. And the other point to be made, and Congressman Welch just made this, is if Boehner, the Speaker of the House, allowed for a vote in the House right now, this afternoon, all of the evidence is the votes are there for a clean, continuing resolution and to reopen the government. And that's what he has got to do.
We want to let our listeners know, if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211 as we talk about the budget shutdown. Representative Welch, what about this argument that the House Republicans are making? One, President Obama has taken the Affordable Care Act. He's delayed the business mandate for a year. Some people in Congress say the president doesn't have the constitutional authority to alter legislation that's already been signed into law. Also, judging by recent polls, a majority of Americans say they don't support the Affordable Care Act. It's likely if it came up for a vote today, it wouldn't pass. And also, there's a new poll that says 9 out of 10 Americans are having a hard time getting on the website. So, given all those factors, why not delay it for a year?
Well, the fact is that the Affordable Care Act was passed by vote of the House, passed by vote of the Senate, signed by the president, withstood a challenge in the Supreme Court. It's controversial. Implementation of any major new law, like Medicare, like Social Security, all has bumps. And if the Republicans and any of us wanted to have discussions about how do we make this work, how do we implement it, what are the things we have to do, that makes sense. But to essentially do an end run around the burden that any of us have if we want to pass or repeal a law, and that is get the votes in the House, in the Senate, presidential signature, Supreme Court validation. That's what's at stake here, that the opponents of health care, instead of getting the votes, electing enough people in the Senate as well as the House, winning a presidential election, they are doing an end run with unprecedented tactics, shutting down the government and threatening to default on America's obligations, many of which they supported us incurring, in order to get their way on a specific policy. That's what's really fundamentally new about this, and I think a very, very dangerous precedent.
But here's what some people are probably thinking. The president decided to delay the business mandate. He said it wasn't ready for prime time. Businesses had too much confusion. You know, if he can do that, why not do it for individuals?
Well, there's two things. First of all, if you get rid of the individual mandate in a bill where every individual is going to be covered, how is that going to be sustainable? You can't have it work at all. That goes to the heart of the financing system of the whole health care bill. If everybody's going to be covered, in my view, everybody has some responsibility to help pay. Secondly, the executive always has some latitude in the administration of a bill. And that's what the president has here. If that's in dispute, that those who would challenge it have an avenue, and that is to go to court and make their case. They haven't done that, and that's because they don't have a case. They really do oppose the health care bill. This has been contentious. And when you say that it's still a dispute in the country, you're right about that, because it is going to be disruptive. But the question here is whether we're going to focus on making it work. The health care system we have is badly broken. This health care bill is, for the first time, a commitment by this country to provide access to care for all of our people. And the question for us at this moment, are we going to make this work, or are we going to use the dispute to do much greater damage by keeping the government shut down and refusing to pay our bills?
Bob, what I said on the floor, and I mentioned it, I've heard Senator Sanders speak on the floor and very, very well on this, especially as a member of the Budget Committee. But what I said, they're acting like children in a sandbox who are fighting. They vote 40 times to totally repeal the Affordable Care Act. Well, if I'm a parent and I've got kids in college, I'm going to kind of like the fact I can keep them on my insurance until they're 25. If I have a family member who has a pre-existing condition, diabetic, heart, cancer, something like that, I'm now very, very happy that I can get insurance and they can't be denied insurance because of pre-existing, and on and on. That's why We've seen millions of people trying to get on the line, so much so that it's crashed some of the systems, because they want to get on there. If they've got a better idea, if they think there are problems, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Give us some ideas of how they'd fix it. The fact is, though, they don't want to have to vote. They don't want to have to vote specifically, do we take your children off here? They don't want to vote specifically, do we keep your family member who has a heart condition away from getting insurance, and on and on.
Bob, let me just jump in and Jane and say this. You can have an honest debate about the Affordable Care Act. All right, I voted for it. I think it needs significant improvements. I am a strong advocate of a Medicare for All single-payer system. I hope Vermont leads the nation in that direction. But having a debate about the pros and the cons of the Affordable Care Act is totally legitimate. What is not legitimate is to say that if we do not get our way and repeal legislation that was passed by Congress, signed by the President, upheld by the Supreme Court, if we do not get our way, we are going to shut down the government, and we're going to, for the first time in the history of the United States, not pay our bills and perhaps lead not only America but the entire world into a financial calamity. That is unacceptable. Second point. Bob, you talked about the majority of the American people not being as supportive of the Affordable Care Act. Those that I've seen those polls, they're a little bit misleading. It is very clear that there are a number of people who are opposed, no question. But you know what? A lot of other people who say, I don't support the Affordable Care Act, something like 16% say, yeah, I don't like it because it doesn't go far enough. The Affordable Care Act would provide health insurance to about 20 million more Americans. We got 48 million people who are uninsured. So those numbers are a little bit misleading.
As we talk about this Affordable Care Act and whether or not we're willing to negotiate, you know, at some point, this just becomes a high-stake game of chicken, and it seems like it's the American people who stand to lose. Why not say, fine, for the good of the people, for the good of the government, to make sure that we can have a government that is functioning, where people are on work and getting paid? Why not negotiate? I know you don't want to, but at what point do you say...
But Jane, we have negotiated. You see, this is the thing. As Bernie pointed out earlier, we negotiated a continuing resolution at the request of the Republican leadership in the House, in the Senate, and we had to vote to cut things that neither one of us would want to cut. But in a spirit of compromise, we cut tens of billions of dollars out and sent it over because they said, if you compromise with this, we will not shut down the government. We'll keep things going. And we sent it over, and then they said, oh, we changed our mind. Now you got to get rid of Obamacare. Of course, we just run a presidential election where one candidate said, I'll get rid of it if I'm elected. The American people resoundingly reelected President Obama. They said, now you got to add this. How many times do we keep giving things? And then they say, oh, wait a minute, now we have a new demand. It really is like children in a playground. Somebody says, well, I don't like the rules that you've made to play soccer, so I'm leaving. Oh, by the way, I'm going to take your soccer ball with me.
Let me just add to what Senator Leahy said, and I agree with him exactly. And here is an enormously important point. We have elections in this country. We are a democratic society. People run on programs. Obama won by 5 million votes. Republicans lost 2 seats in the United States Senate. They lost seats in the House, and in fact, Democrats ended up getting 1 million more votes than they did in the House of Representatives. Republicans lost the election. That's the way it goes. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. If we accede to what they are trying to do, you are setting a horrendous precedent. Because if anyone has any doubt whatsoever that while today it's the Affordable Care Act, next year they'll say, oh, you know what, we're going to shut down the government because we, and this is what many of them believe, we want to eliminate Social Security. We want to end Medicare as you know it. And unless you do that, we're going to default on our debt. We're going to shut down the government. When does it end? And the president, President Obama, made a good point. If he succumbs to this blackmail, the next president and the president after him will be in that position. This is enormously anti-democratic. And essentially what these guys are trying to do is annul the election in which they lost.
They have a whole list of things, from environmental laws to trade laws, that a tiny fraction of the electorate want to repeal, and they'll do anything they can to repeal it. You can't allow that.
Just one addition on that. We should negotiate, and we hear from Vermonters all the time. But there's a process. It's the budget. It's the conference committee. The House has passed a budget. It's the Ryan budget. I disagree with it. The Senate passed a budget, as Bernie said, and Patrick, it's much better. The normal way legislatures, this is how it would be in Vermont. The House passes a budget. The Senate passes a budget. A lot of disagreement. They go into conference and discuss it. Mr. Boehner won't appoint conferees. So he's accusing us of not negotiating, but he won't appoint negotiators.
Representative Welch, some political observers think that many Democrats, including the president, really don't mind having a government shutdown as long as the Republicans get blamed for it. Some Democrats have used some pretty tough language. We hear things about holding the country hostage. You don't negotiate with terrorists. How can you convince Vermonters that this fight is about something more than who wins the 2014 elections?
Well, first of all, there's no winners in this. And the whole political process gets dragged down and people lose their faith in their institutions. And, you know, this Congress, which is held in disrepute, this is a creation of our founding fathers. It is supposed to be representing the people's best interest. And this institution is here to help people be successful back home in their lives. And to the extent that it acts in a way, and who's ever at fault is really of less consequence than the institution is failing, it's bad for the country. So I actually don't like that rhetoric. We've got a real problem. I think it's important for us to try to explain as best we can who's doing what. But bottom line here, there is something I think that Vermonters understand, and that is you do pay your bills. You know, because you're mad at the plumber, you don't stiff the electrician. And you just because you've got a problem in one place in your life, you don't tell the bank you're not going to pay your mortgage. So that's just a basic proposition. Could you imagine one of our governors like Douglas or Snelling, Republican governors, suggesting we don't have to pay Vermont's bonds? That wouldn't happen.
Let's go to the calls. John is on the line with us from Richmond, Vermont. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello, and hello to the entire Vermont delegation. Two quick points. I see this as a dearth of leadership in Congress, and you can take it personally or not, you know. But I don't see that this would have ever happened under, a Senate leader like Mike Mansfield or a House leader like Tip O'Neill, because it never would have gotten to this point. This public bickering is showmanship at this point. All these discussions should be happening behind closed doors where people can have frank discussions. Secondly, and this is why I'm angry, is because this process is hijacking my identity. It's like identity theft. We're projecting an image to the world that we're spendthrifts or we're irresponsible or we're willing to walk up to the cliff without thinking of consequence, both domestically and internationally, and I'm furious, and I'm hoping that my representatives are equally as furious and are going to find a way to either encourage the leaders to do the right thing or do the right things themselves.
Yeah, John, I hear what you're saying. Thanks very much for expressing your thoughts. I want to get another call in here, and then we'll get a response from our delegation. Eric is calling in from Bristol. Hi, Eric. You're on the line.
Hi, and thanks for having me on. As far as what the average person, I'll call myself on the street, is hearing. I mean, first we had sequestration, which has kind of fallen out of the news because it's been replaced by the government shutdown, which is starting to fall out of the news because it's getting replaced with talk about defaulting on our debt. And it seems like this is just a huge, huge hole we keep digging ourselves into step by step. And I'm just wondering how we're ever going to get out of this huge hole. And just one quick other point on the Health Care Act. It seems like there were several states that did not implement their own exchanges like Vermont did. And there is now the complaint about the federal site being jammed up and not working quickly or at all at times. And if the spirit of the law was looked at in the first place by the states of developing their exchanges, I think we'd be having a lot less of those issues.
Eric, thank you for your thoughts today. Appreciate that. So Eric and John both calling in, both angry about where things stand right now. Senator Sanders.
Well, they have every right to be angry, and they have every right to be disgusted. Here's what's happening in America right now, and as everybody knows, the middle class of our country is disappearing. People are working longer hours for low wages. We have more people living in poverty than any time in American history. And what are we talking about? We are talking about shutting down the United States government, denying services to tens of millions of people, denying paychecks to millions of federal workers, and we are ignoring the real problems facing the American people. What are the American people telling us in poll after poll after poll? They're saying, create jobs. My kid doesn't have a job. Raise the minimum wage. Deal with our crumbling infrastructure. Do something about greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. Make sure we have equal pay for equal work. College affordability, a huge issue. And what are we talking about? Should the United States government pay its bills, or do we have an international financial collapse? The only point that I would make, that I want to reiterate, a point that Congressman Welch made before. In Vermont, we have had a long history of moderate Republicans. Everybody knows George Aiken, Bob Stafford, Jim Dick Snelling, everybody. Those are people who we understood. They lived in the real world. What people have got to appreciate is none of those people, Dwight D. Eisenhower, would no longer be accepted into the Republican Party.
I'm not
that
sure.
The party
Ronald
is
Reagan
run
would.
By extremists, and it is posing enormous dangers to our country.
We are talking today with our full congressional delegation, Senators Patrick Leahy and Bernie Sanders, and Representative Peter Welch. We're examining how these elected officials represent the interests of Vermonters here in Washington. We've been looking at the government shutdown. Coming up, we're going to look a little bit deeper at the debt ceiling debate, as well as some specific issues our delegation has been working on. And listeners, you can share your thoughts with us by calling 1-800-639-2211. Or by posting at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition, coming to you today from NPR Studios in Washington.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. We're broadcasting live in the noon hour from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. We're talking with the three members of Vermont's congressional delegation, Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Congressman Peter Welch.
If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post your comments and questions online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And while you're there, you can see photos and tweets from our broadcast here at NPR Studios in Washington. Senator Leahy, you're talking about the government paying its bills, and you say it's important to do that because those bills have already been incurred. Now, if a family had problems paying their bills at the end of the month after they paid them, they would discuss ways to reduce spending in the future. So why shouldn't Congress take the same approach? Why not include a provision to cut spending in the future with the plan to raise the debt limit?
Well, we've done that. I mean, this is what gets lost in this whole thing. We've cut tens of billions of dollars out. We've actually cut hundreds of billions of dollars out already. At some point, you have to ask, where do you continue cutting? You know, we had some of these same people that want to cut back now are the same people that would vote unlimited budgets for Iraq and Afghanistan, wars that we oppose. They would, as one Vermonter said to me, you spend billions of dollars to build roads and bridges in Iraq, and then they just blow them up. Why don't you rebuild our bridges that are falling down and our roads that are falling down here in America, and we'll take care of them? There seems to be some assumption that you can just ignore some of the things that we do as a government. Roads, bridges, one example. But also health care. One of the things they want to cut in doing this is cutting out clinical trials on finding cures for cancer. Now, these are trials that take 10, 12 years. You can't just stop them halfway through and say, oh, but don't worry, we'll give you money next year and you can start them back up again. It doesn't work that way. Everybody says, well, let's just cut out fraud and abuse and waste. Well, fine. Where you find it, cut it out. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. We take out tens of billions of dollars. I've actually voted for hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts over the years of things we don't need. But somehow it gets lost in the fact that there are things as a country for our national defense, for the health and well-being of our people, for education, for our investments in the future. I mean, these same people that want to cut out feeding kids are going to school will ask us, well, who are going to be the scientists and the educators and the and on in the future if we have kids who can't learn today?
Let me ask you this, just to follow up on one thing. I've read that the president might actually have the constitutional authority to raise the debt limit himself.
Under the 14th Amendment?
So if we get to October 17th or the 31st, whatever the magic day is, would you encourage him to do that?
I've asked the Judiciary Committee staff and the lawyers on there, it's basically a nonpartisan staff, to look at it. I thought he did. I'm becoming more convinced he does not have that authority. In a way, it's a moot point because the White House is convinced they do not have the authority. When I raised it with the president, he said to me, the problem with doing that is, one, it rewards Congress for not doing the job they're supposed to, but secondly, just about everything that we are entering into contracts in the future, under that circumstance, people can tie them up in court later, whether you had the authority or not. And it almost opens the door for the same small group of people, if they don't like something you're doing, whether it's environmental laws, something like that, say, oh, wait a minute, he didn't have the constitutional authority to do it, therefore we're going to court. It just creates a greater problem. And what it ignores the fact Congress didn't do the job they're supposed to in the first place.
Congressman Welch,
We met with the president yesterday, the Democratic caucus, and a number of us asked him that, because I actually think he does have the authority under the 14th Amendment, because we're putting him in a position where he either has to violate the law that Congress appropriates money and he has to spend it, or he goes above the debt ceiling. But the point he made is that if we go into this uncharted territory where we literally, for the first time in history, don't pay our bills, we don't know how violently the markets will react. And even if we did the 14th Amendment, does that provide certainty, or does it just continue the uncertainty that Senator Leahy was talking about? So he may have the authority, but that may not provide the security that the markets need, that America is going to pay its bills.
And regardless, moot point, he says he doesn't want to use that. He doesn't believe he has it.
Bob, let me just respond briefly to your question. First point, and Senator Leahy made this point, you talk about budget deficits and cutting spending. In the last 3 years, we have cut the deficit in half, from $1.4 billion to about $700 billion. Still a lot, but anyone who thinks that is not a significant cut is missing the point. Second of all, as a member of the Budget Committee, although you don't have to be in the Budget Committee to understand this, a budget is about two things. It's about revenue, amount of money coming in, and what you spend. The truth of the matter is we are in the deficit situation today largely because of Bush's huge tax breaks for the rich, two wars that the Congress forgot to pay for, and the Wall Street collapse, which resulted in a substantial decline in revenue. That's the reason. And to my mind, when you talk about the budget, yes, I think, for example, we could take a hard look at military spending. We're spending now almost as much money as the rest of the world combined. Should we cut military spending? I think we should. But second of all, you also have to look at revenue. At a time when the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well, large corporations are enjoying record-breaking profits, do I think it's appropriate to ask them to start paying their fair share of taxes to help us so that we don't have to cut nutrition programs for kids or pregnant women? I sure do.
We're talking today with Vermont's congressional delegation, and you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Congressman Welch, you've talked in the past about doing away with the debt ceiling limit altogether, just having an automatic increase. Is that something you would still consider at this point?
Well, I would, because if Congress authorizes, for instance, the war in Iraq, then there are expenditures that are going to have to be appropriated in order to pay the bills. We've got veterans. We've got 1 million returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. and we've got to provide health care for them. So the moment of decision for Congress is the moment they decide to spend the money. And then the bill becomes due, and there's an immense amount of hypocrisy in Congress about that, because the members of Congress who just voted to, as Bernie said, go to war in Iraq, and know there are bills associated with it. When it comes to the debt ceiling, they get fiscally conservative and say they don't want to do it. That's hypocritical.
Senator Sanders, the Republicans are also interested in talking about entitlement reform. They want to look at Social Security. They want to look at Medicare. They want to look at Medicaid. They say all these programs are not sustainable for the next decade or two. Are, as part of a grand bargain here, are you willing to look at some entitlement reform? And what are you willing to look at, and what's off the table?
Okay. Let's again back it up and look at the context of where we are as a nation. More seniors are living in poverty now than used to be the case. Middle class is largely disappearing. Many of the new jobs that are being created are low-wage, part-time jobs, while the people on top are doing phenomenally well. If you ask people out there about Social Security, you know what they say? Social Security is the one area of stability. It's the one pillar that we have now that we know when we get old, we're going to get that check. And it has never failed in the 75 years that it has been in existence. If you want to solve the Social Security problem, and let's be clear about Social Security. Social Security today can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 20 years. It has a $2.7 trillion surplus. Sound like a crisis to you? Not to me. But how do we make it solvent for the next 75 years? Very simply. You got one person today is making $113,000 a year. Another person is making $100 million. Guess what? They both pay the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund. You lift that cap, and you could do as Obama suggested in his first campaign for presidents, even start at $250,000. If you just do that, you'll have solved Social Security for the next 75 years. Terms of Medicare and Medicaid, here is the issue. That's not a budget crisis. It is a health care crisis. Bob, we are spending now twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of any other nation, major nation, who provide health care to all of their people. What we need is to make our health care system more efficient, more cost-effective, and we can provide health care to all of our people without spending any more than we should. Should we be raising the Medicare age of eligibility to 70 years of age? Should we be throwing children and kids off of Medicaid in order to give tax breaks to billionaires? Frankly, I don't think so.
Today on the program, we have the three members of Vermont's congressional delegation. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Mike, who is calling from Charlotte. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hello. This question, I know, is maybe secondary to the current debt ceiling issue and everything, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement that's being negotiated right now between the United States and other countries in the Pacific there. My understanding is that it's being done in secret. Not even members of Congress can find out what's in the terms of the treaty. From what we do know, there are very serious threats to our sovereignty with the idea that corporations who feel that their profitability is impacted by our environmental laws or our consumer protection laws can sue to have those laws invalidated if they are companies that are based outside the United States. Would you be able to give us some comment on that, please?
Senator Leahy. Well,
I'd be happy to. He's talking about the TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership Act. I've joined with several senators in writing to the U.S. Trade Representative and said this is going to be a lot more transparent in the negotiations that are going on. I was hoping that the president would not have had to cancel his trip overseas, because I'm sure this is one of the things that would have been discussed. I like free trade, but not if you're going to have backdoor ways to gut the environment or gut labor laws. Free trade means that we're all playing on the same level field. this has raised too many questions in my mind. The caller raised a number of issues that have bothered me a great deal about it, and that's why I've been contacting the trade representative, and there are even others in there. It can sound like a great thing to do. We do a lot of business. Well, Vermont, for example, exports more per capita than most states. I think that probably all states. But it's got to be a level playing field. You can't say that we will follow labor laws as we should, and environmental laws as we should, but we're going to deal with others that don't have to. And the threat of the international litigation that he's talking about is a real one, and I've asked the Judiciary Committee to take a look at that.
On the other hand, there are questions about this from other countries. Some of the countries in this trade pact, Malaysia, Japan, New Zealand, Australia, notably not China, and maybe we can talk about that as well. But some countries are saying the U.S. is trying to push its own laws on these countries regarding things like the patent laws for medications right. That would go on for much, much longer in other countries than they currently do, right. Senator Sanders.
Well, let me just say this. I agree with Mike's concerns about the TPP. I have been very skeptical about American trade policy from way back when. In fact, I don't believe I've ever voted for any major trade agreement, whether it was NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China. My strong feeling is that a lot of these agreements are pushed by large multinational corporations who want to shut down plants in the United States, among other things, not pay people a living wage, move to developing countries. In Vietnam, for example, which is part of this TPP, workers there make 25, 50 cents an hour. So I think on the surface, these trade agreements have been very harmful to American workers. We've lost something like 50,000 factories in America in the last 10 years, millions of jobs. Same in the state of Vermont. I think we lost about 25% of our manufacturing capability. But the other point, Jane, is exactly what you wrote. One of the strong proponents of this is the pharmaceutical industry. And what they are trying to say to these countries is that you have got to pay top dollar, full price, for brand name prescription drugs rather than being able to move in a reasonable time to generics. These are poor countries. And the point that I think that Mike raised is a lot of this is being done in secret. Corporations have access and are playing a very, very major role in developing this. So I share Mike's concern that I'm very skeptical about this agreement.
Congressman Welch, could a pact like this would be the largest trade pact in history, can it work with Pacific nations without including China? I mean, China, the largest export country in this region, and we're not including them. Could a trade pact work without including China?
Well, first of all, I share the concerns that Bernie and Patrick expressed about the TPP and that Mike expressed that it's all being done in secret. So,
although a lot of people say that trade pacts, when you're negotiating at this initial stage, they are done in secret, and when the language is more finalized, then people will be able to say
we're more
it.
Than initial they, with, stage. That's
yeah,
the problem.
We're beyond the initial stage, and also then they go on the so-called fast track where there's very little opportunity to make adjustments and have a debate about specific provisions. And this generic drug issue is a really big deal. You know, there's a lot of us in Congress really pushing to move towards generics. We've got a big generic pharmaceutical company in Vermont, Mylan, that's doing a great job, and it saved us, the American taxpayer, billions of dollars through generics. But the question about whether it would work with China presumes that it would work for American workers. And the question I have is, will this work for the middle class? Who's going to benefit, whether China is in or China's out? And we don't know. We're all in the dark, and I joined in a letter signed by many of my colleagues urging that this be more transparent. We have an opportunity to weigh in sooner rather than later.
We've gotten a couple of emails on different subjects, and I thought I'd combine two of them. The first one had to do with term limits. Some people think term limits would be part of a solution to the current partisan bickering that seems to dominate Congress. You're all incumbents. Is there an argument to be made that you've had your chance and it hasn't worked, so why not give another group of people a chance to work on a different outcome? And Senator Leahy, the social studies class at Montpelier High School has a question about campaign finance reform and looking at the super PACs and how much money is in politics now. They want to know if you think money is becoming or has become a corruptive force in our politics.
Quick answer to the class of Montpelier, and of course, glad to hear from somebody from Montpelier. I was born in Montpelier. It has become corrupted. very corrupted. And the Supreme Court, in the most unimaginable case, the Citizens United, basically opened the door to people, a small group of people, who can buy elections. They speak about term limits. The problems are being created by people, most of them only been there for 2 or 3 years. Ted Cruz has been there, what, a year and a half in the Senate, and running for president, willing to stop everything going on by doing that. Most of the Tea Party group, the radical Tea Party group over in the House, have only been there for 1 or 2 terms. The ones who are trying to work these things out are the ones who have been there long enough to have some understanding. We saw John McCain, a Republican, on the floor the other day, Carl Levin, a Democrat who's retiring, but speaking sense about what's going on. But the bottom line is we do have term limits in this fact. Every 2 years, there's a term limit on House members. Every 6 years, there's a term limit on senators. It's called an election.
But you're sitting on several million dollars in your reelection account right now.
Several connotes three or more. I think it's well under two, but that's okay. Go ahead.
So you've got a pretty good chunk of cash in your campaign account, and incumbents win 95% of the time.
Well, when I ran the first time, I think I spent around $140,000. The first several elections I had, I was outspent by the other side. I still won. I think it depends upon who it is. One of the nice things about Vermont, we're small enough that people actually get to know you. I mean, I'm all over the state several times a month. I have a listed home phone number. People see me coming out of church, in the grocery store, walking down the street, and they feel they could talk with me. I think the problem is in some of these large states, it's become who can buy the most television, and that's where money becomes a corrupting factor. We saw this in the New York Times on Sunday, where the Koch brothers and Ed Meese have put together about $250 million just to elect people who will agree with their tiny, narrow interests. These are the people that make sure that the wealthiest do not begin to pay the amount of taxes, a percentage of their income, as the average Vermonter does. These are the people who make sure the corporations are protected so they'll be paying no taxes whatsoever. And these are the people that I've got mine, the heck with you and getting yours. And that is a clear example of one of the greatest dangers the Supreme Court created with the Citizens United.
Let me just jump up, because the kids at Montpelier High School raised what is really the most important issue facing our country. And let me tell you how it ties in right now to what we're experiencing today in terms of the shutdown and the threat not to pay our bills. In the House right now, because of the incredible wealth of the Koch brothers, this is one family worth $70 billion, and others, people like Sheldon Adelson. What the right-wing extremists are saying to the more moderate Republicans, they're saying, you want to vote to open up the government, huh? Well, let me tell you what's going to happen. If you vote that way, what I can guarantee you is we're going to have a primary opponent against you who is going to have access to millions and millions of dollars. In the last election, we think the Koch brothers spent hundreds of millions of dollars just on the elections, not to mention setting up the Tea Party and all these other organizations. So unless we get a handle on this campaign finance issue, which to my mind means overturning through a constitutional amendment, Citizens United, and I've offered one, others have offered other amendments, and second of all, moving to public funding of elections. Bob, you asked the question, is it fair for an incumbent to have more money than a challenger? You know what the answer is? No, it's not. Let's move to public funding of elections. There are some cities and states around the country that have made some progress in that area so that members of Congress don't have to spend half their life raising money from billionaires in order to get elected.
You know, a big challenge in the House is the gerrymandering of districts. And state houses that are controlled by one party or the other, and in the last election it was largely Republicans, they made districts that are boutique districts that made no sense geographically but had a real benefit politically to the incumbent party. Both parties do that.
I was going to say that Democrats do it as much as Republicans.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm saying we should have nonpartisan commissions drawing the districts. We do that in Iowa. We do it in California. And that means that whoever gets elected is going to have to appeal to a broader cross-section and not live in that threat that they'll get this primary challenge on the right or the left because they were willing to compromise. So I think gerrymandering and having nonpartisan commissions and not having politicians do it for their own personal benefit is really important.
Let's go to Tiki calling in from Burlington now. Hi, Tiki. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you. You know, as far as the shutdown, just wanted to echo, you know, the same frustration. I think we're preaching to the choir here on BPR. But, you know, it's really pathetic to see the Republicans acting the way they are. But as a segue to what you were just speaking about, my question has to do with special interest groups and, in particular, fundraising. And I wanted to ask each of our representatives how much time they dedicate to fundraising on a regular basis.
All right. How much fundraising do you do on a regular basis? I see some nods, but nobody wants to jump in
Senator
Sanders.
I am luckier than most. I have stated from the beginning of my political career that I don't take corporate PACs. So I don't ask corporations for money. I don't want their money. So that ends that.
Although we have talked in the past as well that you do take union block money.
Yes, I do. Absolutely, I do. I do take PAC money from those people who are supporting workers' rights, supporting the environment, supporting senior rights. Absolutely. But I don't take corporate PACs. Second of all, I've been lucky. We have, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands of individual contributions, which, Jane, if my memory is correct, average about $50 a contribution. I have spent time raising money. But not as much as many others who have a long list of people who would have to call up every single day.
I actually probably spend more time raising money for other senators to the extent I do. I did in Vermont here about 10 days ago. I had people come to Vermont, and all that was to raise money for senators who are up next year. And senators who are especially going in some of the open seats where some of my colleagues have retired. I feel strongly about that. For example, we wouldn't have had the Violence Against Women Act. Wouldn't have been passed if the Republicans had taken over the Senate this past year. We wouldn't have passed the sexual trafficking bill or any of those things that they had. But those I have had, and I'm also not like one of these big states where I have to raise a huge amount of money. I've always had far more Vermonters who have contributed to me than any of my opponents have. Every time I've run, there have been more Vermonters who have contributed to me than my opponents have had contributions. And that's really what counts, because it's only the Vermonters who get to vote.
Congressman Welch, I mean, we hear sometimes stories that people in Washington, representatives in Washington, have to spend half their time at least fundraising instead of doing legitimate business.
That's true for some. I mean, the system is totally broken. I support public financing. I've sponsored legislation for that. But the real world we're in with Citizens United and with the Supreme Court about to take up a case that would take all limits off how much an individual could contribute. We've got a bad situation that could get worse. But those of us who seek the opportunity for public service, none of us like to fundraise. All of us have to. And the good thing is that it's total public disclosure. So anything that Bernie, Patrick, or I raises, those contributions are all available for public scrutiny. You can ask questions. The people we represent can ask questions. And we can do our best to answer them.
But does it bother you to have to spend so much time fundraising?
Yes, it does. And it takes away, it's not as bad for, I think, any of us as it is for some of my colleagues. But I see some of my colleagues have to spend hours each day on the phone trying to raise money. And it really changes the nature of your job. You know, if you're spending a lot of time doing that, you're not spending as much time as you need to getting to know your colleagues, talking to colleagues you don't agree with to try to find out where's the common ground, trying to figure out some way to get from here to there, and really legislating. So it's a real burden, and it gets in the way of doing the fundamental responsibility that you have, and that's legislating.
Jane, let me just pick up on Peter's point, because he makes a very important point. Not only do some members spend hour after hour after hour. What Peter is saying, which is true, you can't just flip a switch and say, okay, now I'm going to worry about unemployment or global warming or other important issues. That's not the way the human mind works. So people get obsessed with raising money. And furthermore, this disastrous Citizens United decision has raised the ante. So if somebody is sitting in Colorado or any state, or in Vermont for that matter, and you know that billionaires can pour millions and millions and millions of dollars in ugly negative ads into your state, what do you think you have to do? You say, well, I have to respond. I have to spend more time raising money. It is a total disaster and a real disgrace to a democratic society.
Senator Sanders, I think a lot of our listeners would be interested to know how you balance your views on an issue with the views of your constituents. And what do you do when you think a majority of the constituents in Vermont feel one way about an issue, but you feel another way? Do you represent their point of view? What do you do?
Well, you do the best you can. That's a fair question. Obviously, I try and believe that on the issues that I fight for and that I believe in, I am, in fact, representing the vast majority of the people of the state of Vermont. I spend a lot of time on economic issues, making sure that working people can have decent jobs at decent pay. I've been working very, very hard to protect Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. I've worked very, very hard to provide community health centers in the state of Vermont, which are now providing almost one quarter of the primary health care in the state. I think almost all of the issues that I have been fighting for, in fact, do reflect the interests of the people of the state of Vermont. Are there occasions when maybe there is an issue where I disagree? I voted against the first Gulf War. Okay, I think at that particular moment, a majority of Vermonters disagreed, and you have to pay the political consequences of that. Sometimes
you also support the F-35s, which many of your supporters find a little incongruous.
Well, but it's that's true. But I would on that one, my own guess is that probably more people support the F-35 than are opposed to it. But you're right. There are many people who are opposed to it. But sometimes you have to vote what you think is the right thing to do, even if not everybody supports you. But I would say in most instances, standing up and fighting for the middle class and working families, the vast majority of the people of the state of Vermont support what I'm trying to do.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders. We're also speaking today with Senator Patrick Leahy and Representative Peter Welch, all three members of Vermont's congressional delegation, here with us today in the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Carry it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page at vpr.net or by calling 1-800-639-2211. This is a special 90-minute broadcast of Vermont Edition. We'll be back with our congressional delegation in just a minute. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm.
And I'm Bob Kinzel. We're broadcasting live in the noon hour from NPR studios in Washington for this special 90-minute broadcast of Vermont Edition.
And again, we have the three members of Vermont's congressional delegation with us today. Very pleased to have all three of them in the studios here at NPR. Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Representative Peter Welch.
And if you've got a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Senator Leahy, you wanted to add a comment.
I just want to say that sometimes you ask the question about how do you vote if you've got people who are on different sides of the issue. Something I do a lot of times at town meetings, we'll take up two or three contentious issues. I'd ask all those who agree with this position stand up. About half the room will. How many agree the other way? The other half the room will stand up. And we go back and forth like that, and I remind them, I get to vote one way, not 49% here, 51% there. And you're going to have to trust my judgment. Just as I became the only Vermonter ever, and my two colleagues were not in the Congress at that time, but I'm the only Vermonter who ever voted against war in Vietnam. The only Vermonter. It failed. It was cut off by a one-vote margin. I caught holy and sure as hell at that time from constituents in Vermont. Now, you can't find anybody who thinks the war in Vietnam was a good idea.
Senator Leahy, as the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, you've talked about the need to change certain parts of the Patriot Act because you think the government has too much power to examine emails and phone calls in the so-called war on terrorism. And if I understand your position, essentially you want the government to prove to a judge that there's probable cause before this kind of surveillance can take place. Now, some of your Democratic colleagues on the Senate Intelligence Committee say the current surveillance techniques have thwarted dozens of terrorist attacks. And they argue that your proposal will make this country less safe against terrorist attacks in the future. Why are they wrong?
Well, for one thing, some of the numbers they use are wrong. And one of the reasons I've had open hearings on this, and we've had the NSA director and others, they were going around speaking, well, this vast surveillance we do of your emails and phone calls and all have thwarted 53 or 54 terrorist attacks. When we asked them specifics, that went from 53 or 54 down to maybe 30 to 20, to finally they said, well, maybe in one case it was essential. My question is this. You could have total security if you have somebody following every single person in this country. We're not a police state. We're always going to be face threats of terrorism. But how much do we want to give up of our privacy? Everybody would understand if you said, look, a government official can come walk in your house any time of the day or night they want and go through all your files or papers at home. You say, that's impossible. We can't allow that. But that is what is happening electronically. And there has to be restraints on that. There have to be, in the so-called secret FISA court, there has to be an ability to have a contrary voice heard. If we don't do this, we are fast moving toward a time where Big Brother is going to know everything you're doing. As a Vermonter, I cannot accept that. And that is why I'm the only one who's held these kind of open hearings. And it's amazing the kind of support I've gotten from the far right to the far left.
Senator Sanders, you know, right now the government does need to get permission from that federal intelligence court before initiating surveillance activities. Some people think this review provides an important check and balance. What do you think? Is it an important check, or are these judges way too quick to approve surveillance activities?
Well, let me begin by agreeing with much of what Senator Leahy just said. Everybody knows that Al-Qaeda is out there. They are plotting against America, and everybody, I think, understands that it's important that we have strong intelligence capabilities and we do everything that we can to protect the people of the United States. But we also have a constitution in the United States, which many of us are extremely proud of. So I voted against the initial USA Patriot Act because I was worried about the powers that it gave to the government. I voted against the reauthorization of that act for the very same reasons. So the issue here is, should virtually every single phone call made by everybody in this country be kept in file, in some secret file for a certain period of time? Should we give the government the capability of going into your emails and your website, the websites that you go to, without having some compelling evidence? So the issue that you raise is, of course we want to be vigorous against terrorism, but the government has got to go into the FISA court and say, this is the reason why we think Mr. X is involved in terrorist activity. And I'm confident that when they make that case, the FISA court will give them the authority to do it, to be as aggressive as they should be in going after terrorism. But to give a blank check to the government to do almost anything that it wants is absolutely, to my mind, unconstitutional. To answer your question about the FISA court, I think the statistics are, I may be wrong on this, Bob, but about 98 or 99% of the requests that come in are granted by the FISA court. So they are acting to a significant degree as a rubber stamp for the intelligence agencies rather than protecting the constitutional rights of America.
And I would say here, the NSA and others would say, well, the reason they agree to all these is that we scrub these things so carefully, and yet it's come out that they NSA engaged in repeated, substantial legal violations by collecting domestic emails of innocent Americans, tens of thousands of them, without going to the court. So, you know, there has to be better oversight. And the court, I feel, should have a public advocate on these serious cases to say, wait a minute, they haven't crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
And the president supported that idea, didn't he?
He does. I've talked to him at great length about this. And as I said, I'm getting support from conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats. We have good intelligence services, but they also make mistakes. Before 9/11, they had all the information that could have stopped 9/11. They hadn't translated half the things. If you collect everything, I would argue you have nothing. They talk about all the things they can collect. Now they're having trouble just handling the electricity in their storage unit out in Utah, as the press has reported. They say how careful they are on this, but they can allow a 29-year-old subcontractor to come in and steal all of these secret files. And then we find that some were also spying on their love interests. Come on.
You know, there's another issue here. Too little privacy for the American citizen with this NSA approach, and too much secrecy for the NSA. We don't even know what the budget is. And members of Congress aren't even briefed on what the budget is. It's all in a big black box. And a question I think we should have on any governmental spending program using taxpayer dollars is, are we getting our money's worth? And the NSA folks, they have some contractors like Booz Allen, for whom Mr. Snowden worked, that make about 95% of their money. In the case of Booz Allen, it was about $7 billion, all from the taxpayer. Are we getting our money's worth, or are they pushing product that we don't need? You know, there's an enormous financial interest for some of these companies to be telling us that we need to have, as an example, everybody's email, everybody's telephone calls. I think most Americans think that's a waste of time and ineffective for the reasons that Patrick said. So I think there should be much more transparency about budgets, as well as more protections for constitutional liberties.
We just have the senators for a couple more minutes here. Actually, all of the Democratic senators have been called to the White House. It's about 1:10 now. They have to leave in a couple minutes. So let's see if we can get one more call in here from Craig, I believe is calling in from Rutland before they leave. Hi, Craig. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking the call. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Senators Leahy and Sanders and also Representative Welch. It makes me proud to be a person who lives in Vermont listening to the three of you today. I really appreciate your comments about the difference between privacy and security. And if we focus too much on security, we're not going to be free. I don't believe. That's not the reason that I called. This is not a question. It's just a comment. It has to do with, again, the shutdown and the debt ceiling. And I'll make it brief. I'm a supporter of Barack Obama. I voted for him. I think he's brilliant in many respects. I believe in the ideals that he's set forth. I'm disappointed in the speaker in terms of his views on the matter. I agree you can't hold the government hostage for negotiation. However, I'd like to encourage the three of you, and if you're going to the White House, I'd like to encourage you to take President Obama aside if you're able to do that. And encourage him.
Let me stop you, Craig, because I hear where you're going, but we really just have a couple of seconds with the senators, and I want to put this to them, and we want to talk about this idea of bipartisanship and how you get along in an atmosphere in Washington that many Americans now feel is toxic, is just toxic partisanship, and feel that it's overwhelmed the government's ability to get anything done for the good of the people that they actually represent. So before we let the two of you go, could you address how you can actually work with your Republican colleagues and hammer things out?
Well, you can. I mean, for example, we, the Senate Judiciary Committee, we passed out of it and then passed through the Senate floor a major immigration bill. They said it couldn't be done. We had 300 amendments filed on, a lot of them killer amendments. We just sat there, heard everybody out, and then voted them up and or voted them down. And both Republicans and Democrats came to the floor afterward and complimented the way that was done. We did it with the Violence Against Women Act. Again, what every piece of legislation I have ever put in and passed, I've had an equal number of Republican as well as Democratic co-sponsors, nearly equal. And it can be done. But when you have some of these people, the Tea Party radicals, they don't want that. They want everything exactly their way, as though only they represent the country.
It's so you're saying it's impossible to work with them because they are
well,
too obstreperous?
But there are still so many people in there, Republicans and Democrats, you can work with. And you have to remember, it's a country of 300 million people. Not everybody thinks alike. Try to find consensus.
Jane, let me answer you. the question by saying this. I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee. We're working very hard to protect and expand the benefits that veterans are entitled to. On that committee, if you would ask the Republicans, I think they would say that we have a harmonious committee. People are working really well together. We've had unanimous support for some significant pieces of legislation. And when there are disagreements, they're honest and respectful. The problem that we are having right now is in that other body in the House of Representatives. That body has been captured, and you have to use the word, right-wing extremists who, you know, are, I mean, what can you say? They are prepared to bring the United States financial system and the world's financial system to a halt if they don't get their way.
Would they call you a left-wing extremist? Well, I mean, are they feeling the same way about you?
Why? Because I defend Social Security, and I think that we should pay our bills, and I don't think we should shut down the government because in order to deny health care to 20 million people, I guess, does that make me an extremist? I don't think so. What we're talking about not is not even their views. You can argue views. It's the methods that they are using. And that is holding the government hostage unless they get their way, despite the fact that they lost the election on those very same issues.
We have to let the senators go now. Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Bernie Sanders have been with us. They're headed to the White House. Yep. Hopefully we're going to fix the government, right? You're going to fix it right now?
Thank you for doing this. You actually have a studio large enough to fit all three of us in it.
I'd love to do it again with you.
Thank you very
Absolutely.
Much.
Thank you for coming. We are, of course, having a special broadcast today of Vermont Edition live from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We're continuing our examination of how Vermont is represented here in Washington with Representative Peter Welch. Thank you, Peter Welch, for being with us for the final 15 minutes. You had your chance at the White House yesterday.
That was yesterday.
Representative Welch, you know, somewhat lost in this whole debate over the budget is the fact that the nation is operating without a farm bill.
Right.
What kind of impact is this having on Vermont, and what's the outlook for a new farm bill before the end of the year?
It creates a lot of anxiety for our farmers because they literally have no safety net at all. And, of course, dairy farmers are at the mercy of the markets. Right now, the milk price is somewhat stable and doing okay, and the feed prices come down a bit. So they're okay at the moment, and I emphasize okay. Okay is when they can hang on by their fingernails. But there are wicked fluctuations up and down in price. And the farmers have no ability to control that. They have ability to do the best they can on their farm. No one works harder. They do everything that they can to economize. But if the price of milk plunges, then the MILC program was there as a safety net to help them get through to the other side. We don't have a farm bill. Milk is expired. It's a very dangerous situation if the market has one of those swings. There's some hope that we're going to go into conference. That's what I've heard today. I mean, the Senate passed bill is a good bill. It created the dairy stabilization program that our Vermont farmers were the principal architects of, and it would have provided them with more price stability and saved taxpayers money. And that was derailed in the House because it was opposed by Speaker Boehner. And we have a big fight in the House on the food stamp program. But it looks like we're going to go into conference, so that at least makes it possible for us to get an agreement. And my hope would be that we'd come out with something very close to what the Senate passed.
So that new plan essentially would allow farmers to purchase price insurance so that when prices drop below the cost of production, the insurance payments would kick in. It's a voluntary program. We've heard from some Vermont dairy farmers who say they can't afford price insurance on top of all the other costs they have. What are they supposed to do?
Well, first of all, the Vermont farmers are the ones who principally advocated for this. It's not unanimous, but they put this together as something that would provide them with more security. And depending on the size of the farm, it might have some different impact on the farmers. But we worked with the co-ops and we worked with the farmers, and this is something that they proposed as is preferable to the MILC program. Each individual farmer would have to make the decision whether they wanted to buy into that as an alternative to the MILC program or not. So there is control at each farm level.
Speaking of unanimity or the lack thereof, there have been a lot of questions in the last couple of years as we debate the new farm bill about whether or not food stamp programs, food assistance should be split from agricultural programs. And our delegation has in the past been strongly against splitting those programs. But in order not to hold the agricultural programs hostage, would you be willing to split them at any point?
I think it's a bad idea, but it has been split. In the House, they separated out the Republican leadership. That's a decision that Speaker Boehner and Mr. Cantor can make. They separated food stamps from the farm, from the all the other provisions in the farm bill. So that's happened. But now they're getting merged if we go into conference. But I think it's a bad idea. You know, there's strength in unity. And there's a lot of interest on the nutrition program, often from urban legislators who don't have familiarity with dairy or other agricultural programs. And there is an ability to work back and forth to help each other. And in fact, there has traditionally been strength in unity. And separating this, I think, is bad for the farmers and bad for nutrition.
We did get this email from Chris in Colchester who wrote us, can anything be done to bypass the Speaker of the House and force a vote on the Senate's continuing resolution? It seems like one man is holding up the democratic process. There is a way to do that. I believe it's called a discharge petition in the House. Is that something the Democrats should look at?
We're doing it. In fact, I've signed a discharge petition, and I expect that I believe almost all of the Democrats have signed it. And there's a number of days that have to pass before it is actionable.
It's like 30 days.
I think there might be a provision where it's fewer days than that. But the point is, there's real obstacles. There's a number of days that have to pass. That's one. But the more significant obstacle is the political one of getting some of the majority members, the Republicans, to sign a discharge petition. And that would be seen as an act of radical defiance of the leadership if they signed it. So it's easy for the Democrats to sign it. We've all said we'd vote for a clean continuing resolution. Can we find some Democrats who would be willing to do, or Republicans who'd be willing to do that? That's the question.
Well, let's go to John, who's calling in from Stratford. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. First, I want to say I agree with our delegation on their position. But we got a real problem here. The government's shut down. We're facing financial catastrophe, and we got to find an answer. When two parties don't agree and can't find a solution, sometimes they go to binding arbitration. Would consideration of adoption of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, the Bowles-Simpson report, be a way out of a face-saving way out of this? If people agreed to what was a bipartisan, thoughtful way of dealing with our financial situation, to say, okay, we can't agree, we're going to go with a Bowles-Simpson as a way out.
Well, it's theoretically possible, but as you remember, Paul Ryan was a member of that commission, and he voted against it. So there's you theoretically could do it. But really, what's going on here that's different than the normal negotiations in a budget? You know, we always have a debate about the size of government, what's proper level of spending, what's the proper level of revenues. There is a significant element in the House of Representatives, people who believe that institutions are the problem. And they actually think that human liberty is best achieved when we're unencumbered from institutions. My view, that's what's radically different. You know, the traditional Republicans that I've been familiar with in Vermont believed in personal responsibility, paying your bills, and part of that personal responsibility was that you would invest yourself in building a local institution. It might be the fire department. It might be the local library. It might be serving in the legislature. But there was an understanding, based with some humility, that in order for us as a society to do well, we had to give of ourselves to an institution that would help carry on the values that are important to our kids and to our communities. And that's being challenged by a lot of the Tea Party folks. So their view is that you unravel these institutions, whether it's the Securities and Exchange Commission or the FDA, that we'll all be better off on our own. And I obviously think that is a grave mistake.
You're part of a group called the Problem Solvers, 40 House Republicans, roughly 40 House Democrats. I'm wondering if the dilemma facing this group right now is those 40 Republicans, if they want to have a clean continuing resolution, they have a target on their back in a Republican primary. And if Democrats of the group support some entitlement reform, they also face a challenge from the left. So given those realities, how can this group, which has been founded to be a bipartisan group, how can it play a role in ending this impasse?
Well, it's pretty limited in ending this impasse, because this impasse is at the top level with Boehner and Reid and the president. And in fact, there's a lot of jeopardy for some of those Republicans for the reasons that Bernie mentioned. If they indicate they're willing to compromise, that's a four-letter word for some folks in the Tea Party. And then Heritage Action, Club for Growth pour lots of money into their gerrymandered districts where their threat is from somebody on the right. And it's why I think gerrymandered districts are a real scourge in the House of Representatives. But what there is potential for us in the problem solvers is to pick issues that are below this top line knife fight kind of battle that's going on now on things like, say, energy conservation. So I'm working with the Colorado representative, Cory Gardner, very, very conservative, but he believes in energy conservation. There's a number of issues where we can do confidence building, trust building, and try to get things done, which is what I hear Vermonters want us to do. So we can't solve all the problems, but we can make progress and try to restore some functionality to the institution of Congress that does belong to the people of this country.
Congressman Welch, since we just have you here now, I could have asked all of your colleagues, but now you can talk behind their back since they're not here. We'd like to know, since we are here in Washington with you, how much you interact. How much does the delegation get together to talk about Vermont issues, to talk about priorities in Washington as a threesome?
You know, quite a bit. We're really lucky. Because we've known each other for years and years and years. I knew Bernie when he was first elected for mayor. The first political campaign I worked on when I came to Vermont was Patrick Leahy. So we're friends. And even when we all weren't part of the delegation, a lot of us were in politics and we had to interact. So we've got a very close relationship. And one of the things that's been so helpful to, I think, Vermont is that, in fact, we're on the same page and we try to help each other a lot. When I first got to the House, I was the new member. Patrick and Bernie were both incredibly helpful to me, introducing me to people if I had a problem they could help with. By talking to a House colleague, they would. So there's a lot of interaction and a lot of interaction by our staffs as well. And I think we all realize that each of us can be stronger in doing our job for Vermont if we help the other. And that's been the spirit. You know, if we want to punch above our weight when we only have a three-person delegation, we do it by working together.
When I talked to you at the end of last week, you said you were optimistic and hopeful that there wouldn't be a government default on October 17th. What's your feeling today?
I think we're not going to have a default, because what you see today, even with the speaker floating the six-week extension idea, which is obviously really short-term and way less than what we should have, is a recognition that it's the unthinkable and that the damage that would be done from a default is just too catastrophic to even contemplate. So what I'm seeing is the Republicans are moving towards trying to extricate themselves, climb down from this tree of the debt default. Now, that's progress, but it's not us doing our job. I mean, the American people are entitled to a budget that's a pass by Congress, and they're entitled to confidence that we'll pay our bills and not play Russian roulette with our economy.
We just have about 30 seconds left, and I'm going to give Trudy the last question. She says, you know, this is sickening, the same old blame game, and both sides should be sent packing. They're there to serve us, and they're unable to complete their basic job function. Disgraceful. What can you do to convince people like Trudy that you are working in the best interest of Vermonters and the nation?
Well, see, this goes back to the question Bob asked me earlier. It doesn't do any good to be in the blame game. And the use of the big rhetorical terms attacking each other, I think, just brings the institution down even further. What I try to do is be clear about what the issue is. And we've got one issue, and that's passing a budget. That should be give and take. We've got another principle. Do you pay your bills? And Vermonters understand you pay your bills. You don't not pay your bill, as I said, to the electrician because you're mad at the plumber. You don't threaten to stiff the bank because you bought a house you couldn't afford. You try to figure out how to deal with it. So that's something that both sides should acknowledge. We have to pay our bills. Then if people hear it, then they can make a decision about who's responsible.
Representative Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
That is going to do it for today. Tomorrow, Bob and I will be back here at NPR Studios in Washington to continue our examination of how Vermont is represented in D.C. We'll be talking with Beltway reporters about whether a small state with a liberal reputation can make an impact on Washington politics.
Vermont Edition's broadcasts from Washington are produced by Patty Daniels with support from Rick Sangeri and Sage Van Wing. Peter Biello and Chris Albertine engineered today's program from Vermont.
Our engineering team at NPR in Washington is Melissa Marquis and Chris Nelson. Special thanks to NPR's Emily Dagger.
Funding for this project was provided by the VPR Journalism Fund. I'm Bob Kinzel.
And I'm Jane Lindholm. Tune in tomorrow for more from Washington, D.C.